Hello and welcome to the Technically Legal Podcast. This is podcast number 70 for October 5th, 2010. My name is Ben Snickoff and I'll be one of your hosts. With me, I've got
Dominic Rabia
and David O'Brien.
As usual, we've got three stories for you. First, we're going to talk about COICA and define what that is when we get to that story. Secondly, the Department of Justice has settled a no-poaching agreement between some Silicon Valley companies. And finally, a judge has ordered that Facebook has to turn over some photos that were previously deleted from a user's page. And we'll address each of those in turn. So first, as I mentioned, is COICA. And COICA, for those of you unfamiliar, stands for Combating Online Infringement and Counterfeits Act. And what this is a bill that was introduced into the Senate September 20th, 2010, by, among other people, Senator Leahy of Vermont, Orrin Hatch, Senators Whitehouse, Knobblocker, Schumer, Cole, Specter, Durbin, Bea, Voinovich, and Feinstein. And what this bill, in its original version, and we'll touch on how the original version differs from the current version that's in the Senate. What this bill originally did was basically provide two types of blacklists for the Department of Justice to set up. First was a blacklist that was set up by the Department of Justice, and the Department of Justice could put on any website that it deemed to be infringing. Basically, any website that, and I'm quoting statutory language now, was primarily designed and has no demonstrable commercially significant purpose other than infringing on either copyrights or trading in other counterfeit goods. So one of these two blacklists, like I mentioned, is for the Department of Justice to say these sites are on a blacklist, and ISPs, you have the option of blocking these sites. And then there was going to be another blacklist, which was a judicially maintained blacklist, where basically what would happen is the Department of Justice would go to a judge and say, listen, judge, we think that these sites should be on this mandatory blacklist. And if a site, if the judge agreed that the sites had no use other than, had no commercially significant purpose other than distributing infringing or counterfeit goods, then that would go on a mandatory blacklist that ISPs had to block. And this pretty much would only apply to domain names over which the U.S. government had some leverage, or sites that were registered in domestically. Although, now that I look at this, there is some mechanism for getting non-domestically registered sites in there. But it would be primarily over .coms, .orgs, .edus, and .nets. So before we dive into this further and discuss, you know, the amendments that have come up into the bill, what are your initial thoughts on that, on the bill, David?
Well, you know, I think that there's a lot of folks over in Hollywood who are probably really in favor of a bill like this making its way through. I think that the disturbing thing to me, at least initially, was the way that the bill treats allegations of infringement in comparison to, say, actual instances where infringement has been confirmed. And it seems to sort of give a little bit of deference to people who make allegations of infringement, and there's always the possibility that that mechanism can be misused.
Right, and there is a procedure set up in this bill, and I'm not entirely sure how the current version of this bill differs, but basically there is a judicial review process. So if you were put on the list, you could object to that and then basically get in front of a judge, and the judge could make a determination based on the record that you would develop there as to whether or not your site should actually be on this list. But in the meantime, your site would be on a list that essentially any ISP, any, you know, provider of internet services or actually provider of internet access could have you on a blacklist for that time, during which time you'd be, you know, potentially losing hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands of dollars a day. Dominic, did you have any initial thoughts?
It seems like a strange sort of bill. I mean, perhaps strange isn't the word. I mean, it's certainly controversial, but it just seems like this doesn't feel like something the government should be doing at all.
That we should... I mean, the government... So how does this bill differ from the Anti-Cyber Squatting Consumer Protection Act, something where it has, you know, some very similar goals and mechanisms where a private party could go in and say, not only is this site infringing and we'll have a judge decide whether or not they, you know, this site infringes on our trademarks, but then you'll have to turn that over. You know, how is.
Right, but that one has at least some sort of arbitration or judicial oversight through the UDRP process. Here, you just have government-created blacklists, and one of them will be compiled even without judicial review. So that's
Right.
troublesome.
And, okay, I think it's important to mention that after the outcry that followed the announcement of this bill, which has bipartisan support in the Senate, but as far as I know, no sponsor yet in the House of Representatives. Once there's some outcry, it has since been amended to remove the Department of Justice administered blacklist. So now, at least according to news reports, again, I haven't actually seen the language that relates to this, but you would be taking out the government created blacklist, and now it would just be the Attorney General's office, the Department of Justice would petition a judge to put a site on, to petition a to petition for a site to be put on the mandatory blacklist. There's no discretionary blacklist anymore.
Okay, so they've changed stuff.
Right.
They have, and it keeps evolving. That's one of the difficult things of trying to keep up with the news that you're reading from articles that, you know, from other tech blog sites that are reporting on this, and of course, what's happening in real time over in the Senate.
Right, and a lot of this may be hay about nothing because the Senate has adjourned for, I think most of Congress has adjourned until the election. And so this isn't going to be acted upon before the election, and even after it's been acted, even if the Senate, you know, when the Senate reconvenes, I think they're supposed to reconvene something like November 20th in a lame duck session, you know, there's a question as to whether or not this will be acted upon then, and again, even if it's acted upon in the Senate, the same bill hasn't been introduced in the House. So there's a good chance that this is much ado about nothing, but it's certainly a do.
So, have you guys gotten a feel for at least the in the current state of the bill, or at least as familiar with the bill as you are, how this interplays with the notice and takedown section in the DMCA, if at all? Well, notice and takedowns, of course, provide a means for a copyright holder or an authorized agent to make a claim against a website that contains allegedly infringing material, and of course, there's a procedure by which, after issuing a notice, the content then gets taken down. And this is, of course, in with websites that have user-generated content. So I'm kind of curious. I just haven't read some of the text, or at least not the recent amendments, closely enough to figure out, you know, if this affects that process at all. Is this going to be the new process of trying to get a website listed on a blacklist, assuming, of course, that this bill went through in its current form, or if, you know, there's going to be some level of legislative deference to the way that the DMCA is currently set up.
Well, looking at the bill, it seems to be a different path to a similar end, but there is a portion in the amendment that's been proposed that says, quote, "Nothing in this subparagraph shall affect the limitation on an entity's liability under 512 of Section 17 of the U.S. Code, which is under the DMCA." So they're saying that this bill doesn't affect immunity, DMCA immunity, but as far as whether or not how this interplays, that's yet to find out. The DMCA is kind of a content owner's remedy, while this bill, COICA, seems to be a governmental remedy. This is, you know, it's almost quasi-criminal. It's essentially taking a domain name or forcing it down, forcing the domain name to be taken down if there's substantial infringing activity going on the site. As opposed to the DMCA, which is kind of more surgical. You're just taking out, you know, the offending portion, or, you know, well, you're taking out the offending portion, but it's on the content owner as opposed to on the government or on the site owner to identify and take down that information.
I mean, my understanding is still that the content owner has to flag these websites that are allegedly, you know, just infringing websites, basically, that are providing infringing content, right?
Under this bill, I mean, I don't remember seeing anything. My guess is the way it would work is people would bring certain sites to the attention of the Department of Justice, then the Department of Justice would act.
Well, yeah,
But
so
I don't.
I Yeah,
right.
what I'm saying is it's not very different in form, I think, from the way the DMCA currently works. I mean, you're right that if you're issuing a DMCA notice to a website owner, it's going directly to the owner, or in this case, you might be giving it to the government. But in either case, you know, sort of the underlying premise of having infringing copyright material is the fact that it's not authorized. And it seems to be that the only person who would be in the position to determine whether something was authorized or not is the content holder or the copyright owner.
Right, and this does also apply to trademarks and counterfeiting. So not only would this affect something like the Pirate Bay if there were, you know, TiffanyKnockoffs.com that only sold knockoffs of Tiffany goods, then that would also fall under the auspices of this act. Which I guess makes it kind of the hybrid love child of the DMCA and the ACPA. Which is interesting. ACCPA.
Yeah, this is an interesting bill. I mean, I keep hearing from time to time, at least I hear things from sort of the congressional and Senate sides of the world where apparently people are complaining enough that they're starting to listen that combating piracy, copyright piracy online is really difficult. And perhaps that's evidenced by the RIAA and their difficulty in, you know, actually changing the way that things work, especially with regard to the internet and the way that things are easily copied from one place to another. And we've seen a lot of suits that have been filed against a large number of defendants, and we've also seen a lot of courts sort of turn a critical eye to some of those, but they don't really seem to be quite as effective, although I have also heard studies that have said that overall piracy has gone down to some extent now that you have easy ways to buy relatively cheap songs and other types of content online through Amazon and iTunes and stuff.
Yeah, interestingly, this bill also has a provision similar to the Anti-Cyber-Squatting Consumer Protection Act, which is that the Attorney General may commence what's called an in rem action against the domain name, which is that they don't actually have to sue the registrar of the person who registered the domain name or the person who's running the site. They can simply file a notice and say, well, we're going after the site itself. So, you know, the case name would be something like United States versus technicallylegal.org. And these are always of some amount of dubious, what's the word I'm looking for? I don't want to say constitutionality, because I think they're fairly clearly constitutional under very old precedent. But there's a notion of fair play that if I use a registrar in California, but I'm in Massachusetts, the DOJ can go after the website where it's registered in California, and you know it'd be very expensive for me, a resident of Massachusetts, to try to defend my website. I'd have to hire counsel in California. I'd have to presumably fly out to California every now and then to actually deal with this.
Well, I don't know. Sometimes I think that at some point we're going to see a bill like this finally make its way all the way through. I just think that there's been enough complaining going on and people are listening, but who knows what the actual form will be. And to your point, Ben, yeah, I mean, I think it's partially like a sort of like a fair play sort of argument. And it also strikes me as a little, you might have due process problems here. And I like the idea of having some measure of judicial oversight. And as long as the bills, you know, comply with the law that's out there in terms of constitutional law precedent, I suppose it's okay. I really need to read some of these things closer and think a little bit more critically about them.
Right. Dominic, any thoughts about this? You've been quiet for a little while.
Yeah. You guys have been doing a good discussion. So, I mean, I'm curious to see what sort of form this will actually be put in finally. The fact that it hasn't gotten a sponsor in the House yet is perhaps heartening in that sense.
Yeah, and won't get a sponsor in the House before November 20th when Congress reconvenes. And even then, I mean, if the House bill is different from the Senate bill, they'd have to get both of the bills passed, go into conference, try to resolve the differences between the two, and then get them back out. For one more vote before you send it to the president and the president signs it. So I don't put a lot of hope on this being resolved in in the lame duck session between, November 20th and whenever they leave, finally, which has got to be, before the middle of December. The other thing that I do want to mention before we move on is that ISPs, service providers, and they're actually defining service providers under Section 512(k)(1), which again is the Digital Millennium, part of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act. So anything that's a service provider, if I'm reading this right, under the DMCA is also a service provider under this act. That they have to as expeditiously as reasonable, take technologically feasible and reasonable steps designed to prevent a domain name from resolving to that domain name's IP address. And that's what once these court orders issue to block a site, that's what the ISPs would have to do. And I guess if I had one more parting shot at this, it's that now that the only method to blacklist a domain is judicial review, there's some hope that the judges would execute a more exacting level of scrutiny, that they'd bring the First Amendment considerations into account before blacklisting a domain name. On the other hand, they may just apply the statutory language and wait for somebody to challenge it to determine whether or not they actually have to subject this to more scrutiny. Any last thoughts on this story before we move on?
Well, I have a question, and that's, is this really going to be effective if what we're talking about is just blacklisting the resolution of a domain name into an IP address? I mean, won't that just eventually turn itself into having very private networks where IP addresses to web servers are shared amongst friends and they still connect and still share content, and it's, much less transparent than it is now where you actually have listed domain names?
One could only hope that that's what happens. I mean, that would be a pretty reasonable. I mean, I'd rather the blacklist not circulate because I'm still fear that they'd be abused. But if the remedy here is that the DNS server entry for the websites get deleted and you can just pass around the IP addresses, I'm fine with that. Being a workaround.
Yeah, I guess I'm just not sure if it will ultimately be effective because, as the last 15 or so years have kind of shown us, whenever the legal system finds a new way to restrict piracy, the people who seem to engage in the piracy just find a new way to route around those restrictions.
Right, I could think of it'd be pretty easy to set up subdomains or rotating subdomains or just registering a new thing somewhere else, registering a new domain name, somewhere where it's much harder for the US to shut it down or get these court orders and have a fairly reasonable workaround there. So, Dominic, do you want to take us into the next story?
Sure. So our next story involves deleted Facebook posts. Basically, what happened is this lady, Mrs. Romano, stopped working and claimed that she was basically bedridden and I guess got some sort of disability insurance or employment, some sort of compensation. In any case, that's not the important part of the story. The important part of the story is that she posted photos on Facebook and MySpace that showed her happily not bedridden, not housebound, enjoying life away from home and being healthy and having a good time. Wisely, or perhaps cleverly, she deleted these photos after realizing that, wait a second, this is probably not the world's best thing to show to my friends. But this story comes up because the judge ordered that the photos that were deleted and the materials that were deleted come back. So basically, that means that she posted stuff to Facebook and deleted it, and now the court is ordering it basically to be discoverable, that what was deleted is now available again.
Right, ordering Facebook to go through their records, and if they have a record of these photos, to produce them to the court. I can't say I'm particularly surprised by this.
I'm not surprised by it either, but I am disturbed by it, if that makes sense.
That Facebook keeps these after you delete them, or that a judge would order Facebook to retrieve them from its archives.
Both, actually. The first probably more so than that. I mean, if you delete a post, you'd hope that Facebook would actually nuke it. Like, there's no recovery options in Facebook. Like, once you delete a post, you can't really undelete a post, so it's not like they're keeping it around there in case you accidentally click the wrong button. Makes you really wonder why they're keeping stuff. And some of these things are, like, almost 90 days afterwards in this court case, and apparently Facebook still has the post there. That's kind of disturbing.
Right, right. That is interesting. Although, again, I guess we're substantially more worried here about Facebook's policies than we are about the judgment itself. You know, on the flip side, just to go down a different path here, if Facebook were out of the picture and somehow the defendant, the insurer or the company, whoever the other party is here in this workers' compensation issue, whoever that is, if they somehow got wind that this woman had these photographs and ordered that sought a subpoena or discovery to get these, and it came out that after the start of the litigation the woman had deleted these photographs, there would have been a discovery sanction anyway. There probably would have gotten somebody to testify as to what these photos once contained, or somebody who could testify that they were there when the photos were being taken, and the woman would be sanctioned one way or another for deleting what was very clearly relevant evidence in this proceeding. So, you know, one way or the other, these would have come in to hurt her, or her deleting them would have come back and nipped her in the butt and also, you know, damaged her case rather substantially. You know, it's possible that these photos are less bad than what the sanction would have been. The sanction could have been something, you know, so severe as to prevent her from introducing any evidence of her being bedridden. You know, and that probably would have totally killed their case. If, you know, this is her sitting down smiling somewhere, that's very different from, you know, maybe she got out and she had help getting to wherever she was sitting down smiling in a bar or whatever.
Right, right. That's very different than jumping around on a trampoline somewhere or something.
Right, and we should mention that we don't really know what the contents of these pictures are.
No. So the interesting thing is in the Facebook privacy policy, it says removed or deleted information may persist in backup copies for up to 90 days, but will not be available to others. That's all it says. So why does the court get access to it?
Because the court has power to subpoena this information and, you know, hurt Facebook if Facebook doesn't turn it over. You know, a end-user license agreement in this case does not, you know, trump the court's ability to hold Facebook in contempt for not turning over this data.
Right, no. I agree and understand. It's just that Facebook doesn't seem to make that clear in their privacy policy, but will not be available to others except if a court subpoenas us. Like, basically, my discomfort here is that people think that their information on Facebook is secure, and it's really not. And the judge, in fact, in this case, went so far as to say that, oh, she posted stuff on Facebook. That's pretty much like posting publicly. She has no expectation of privacy.
I thought that these were posted. Were they available only to friends, or were they actually posted publicly? Was that information available? Essentially, do we know what the privacy settings on her account were?
Yeah. I think at least some of the photos, like the judge wrote, in that regard, it appears that the plaintiff's public profile page on Facebook shows her smiling happily in a photograph, which to me implies that there were no privacy settings. It was her public profile picture, at least so much. But I'm not sure whether other photos were. And that's actually an interesting thing to consider. Like, what if one of the photos were deleted, but deleted.
Yeah, what if the
had
photos
some
were
privacy
sent
restriction? Friends only, right?
Right, or friends direct only, or if it was, you know, something that you attached to a Facebook direct message and that was only available to one person. You know, I don't think that changes the math in this case. I think it may change a little bit if there were a Fourth Amendment concern, if this were a criminal trial and the government was trying to, you know, get this information from Facebook. There, I think you've got a slightly more interesting question. But here, if these really were public, I think it's absolutely fair for them to be subpoenaed in a civil matter. David, I know you had to step away for a second there. Do you have any thoughts from what you've heard so far about this?
No, not so much. Actually, I always defer to you, Ben, as being sort of the procedural expert on our little panel here. But it's sort of an interesting case, I think, and I'm sure you guys have already covered this when I had my headphones off, but it, you know, just kind of goes to show you that when you put stuff up online anywhere, regardless of your privacy settings and what you think is going to happen to those files, they could persist there for a very long time. And also what's sort of interesting is the interplay with some of the clauses that you see in privacy policy agreements whereby it says, oh, okay, we're not going to share this information with these people, and, you know, the agreement lists a certain number of people, but, you know, if we have to do this to comply with a court order or some other concept under the law, then we will, in fact, disclose it under those circumstances. And this looks to me like you have a scenario where, you know, somebody is attempting to get the information, and Facebook was, in fact, complying then with the both their privacy policy and the law as well.
That makes sense. Any other thoughts on this story, Ben?
Yeah, I think I'm all set. And this is a fairly straightforward story.
Yeah. All right, David, if you want to take us away to our last story, go for it.
Yes, yes. Our last story is, I guess we're all out of order now since I had to stand up for a moment, but our last story is all about the Department of Justice and six technology companies, including Adobe, Apple, Google, Intel, Intuit, and Pixar. News surfaced this week that the Department of Justice filed suit against those companies, alleging that they had engaged in restraints of trade by contract. There were five separate agreements, according to the complaint, and the agreements were between Apple and Google, and separately Apple and Adobe, and Apple and Pixar, and Google and Intel, and Google and Intuit. Basically, what all of these agreements said is, we agree that we're not going to poach employees from you, and more specifically, cold calling recruiting from employees. What's interesting is that the Department of Justice here is defining the market as employee talent. And what they're saying is these companies engaged in an express agreement which then restricted trade in the employee talent market. And also what surfaced on the same day, basically, is that there is a proposed final judgment that's actually pending in the court that this was filed. And I think this was filed in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. And the proposed final judgment says, and all the companies have apparently signed on to this, that all the companies will be prohibited from entering into, maintaining, or enforcing any agreement that effectively restricts trade, and specifically cold calling, recruiting, or trying to restrict the way in which companies can compete for each other's employees. So did you guys have any initial thoughts on this?
I think it's an interesting way to get around California's ban on non-competes.
Yeah, absolutely. As we covered, I think, a week or two ago, California is sort of famously known for having a prohibition on non-compete agreements for employees, and a lot of people actually credit that being the reason, or at least one of the reasons, which made Silicon Valley what it is today. And people point to some of the other technology hubs around the country, including Boston, since we here in Boston, you can have non-compete agreements, but since you don't have them in California, it was more attractive for some of the best employees or the most well-credentialed employees to go out and work for some of the tech companies and then sort of bounce around, and competition was also very strong, too.
How does this actually not be a non-compete? I thought non-competes were, I'm an employee, I agree not to work anywhere else, right?
Well, it's the flip side of the non-compete. That, you know, it's not the employee being prohibited from working anywhere once they leave. It's the other companies that would hire the employee saying, well, we're not going to hire you because you worked at one of these companies where we had an agreement not to poach you. I mean,
well,
presumably it would be.
I mean,
it
that's
would be
not
different.
What it is, right?
Yeah.
This was an agreement not to hire them. It's just an agreement not to cold call them.
Right. It's similar. It's not.
Not to
it's
recruit.
Not identical.
I mean, the best way to put it is this was all about recruiting employees from competing companies. Now, that does not, of course, prohibit an employee from one of those companies that was involved in one of these agreements to go to the other company that was already in the agreement and apply for a job over there. And I don't think that there was anything that would restrict whether or not that company that the employee had applied to, whether or not that they could eventually hire him. This is all just about recruiting techniques. And apparently, according to the Department of Justice, this is a very effective way to get employees from your competitors.
Cold calling people is?
Yes. Actually, this is something that happens a lot in at law firms. Of course, it's a little bit easier when you're at a law firm because especially the large law firms, most of the attorneys have a public page which lists, among other things, their email address and a phone number that they can be reached at. So it's not unusual to get several calls during the week asking you if you perhaps want to make a move to one of the other law firms in the same metropolitan area that you're in, or maybe even a different one, or to go in-house.
Yeah, I mean, headhunting, I guess, is the way it's usually referred to. But, I mean, Google actually made a post here on their public policy blog about this, and they said that they just decided not to cold call employees, so not telephone them, but they would still recruit via LinkedIn, job fairs, employee referrals, or if someone approached Google directly, they would hire them, so...
Well, apparently, according to the agreement, at least the one between Apple and Google, I think that I don't know if this was written. This is all based off of what the Department of Justice's complaint reads, and it said that they had provisions or some sort of terms that were agreed upon that if there was ever an instance where either Google employees or Apple employees did in fact engage in some sort of cold call recruiting, that they would have to write up a report about it and send it over to the other company if, you know, either the other side had alleged that, you know, there somebody was violating the agreement.
I think Google and Apple actually had different things of what they actually did. Google just had a don't cold call thing, where Apple just had a do not call, do not solicit employees from this company.
And what strikes me about this is really about the market for, say, salaries for employees, and the Department of Justice also focused particularly on computer engineers and computer sciences scientists, and they said that, you know, those are the ones, the people with the core talents who were being recruited from these competitors. But the agreements didn't really distinguish, apparently, between that, and it applied to all employees. But if there are, you know, if there are such agreements that are running around out there, then that means, you know, that it might be more difficult, or maybe the computer scientist who's working at his desk and who receives a phone call and it says, "Hey, would you like to come work for Google? We will bump your salary by 2x." That sounds like a pretty attractive offer, and I might be willing to take it if I was in that position. You know, obviously these types of agreements are restricting the ability to do that, and so the market isn't as much about say the technology. It seems to focus more on your job and as a employee of either of those companies.
Yeah, I mean, on the whole, this sort of practice will depress salaries or will make salaries lower than they otherwise would be.
Yeah, I think that this is, at least it strikes me as, a fairly clear antitrust violation. You're talking about, you know, six major players in the recruiting market, in the employer market, or I guess they're in the market for employees, making an agreement to, you know, essentially restrain trade to not take otherwise available employees. It's just interesting because it's tech companies, particularly the non-compete. Well, the agreement between Apple and Pixar, that Apple and Pixar would not poach employees from each other. You'd think that they'd be a little nicer to each other about that.
Yeah, Pixar is a spinoff of Apple. No, it was founded by Steve before he came back to Apple, right?
Right. Steve is, I think, the president or CEO of both companies. I forget what Steve Jobs' actual title is at Apple. But yeah, he was the founder of Pixar, and now Pixar is owned by Disney.
I believe his title is God. Just kidding, of course.
Yeah, he's on the board of Disney, but he used to be the CEO of Pixar. And he's CEO of Apple right now, officially. As well as chairman.
Okay, yeah, he doesn't seem to have an official position at Pixar, at least not among the He's not president, he's not chief creative officer. Yeah. Still founder, though.
So, in other
Oh,
news, I guess.
wait. Strike that. Chairman and CEO. Just looking at the wrong part of the Wikipedia page. He is chairman and CEO of Pixar.
Oh,
And he may
Pixar?
not have
Oh.
found it. It began as a division at Lucasfilms, and he bought that division for $10 million in 1986.
So it's always been separate then from Apple, is what you're saying.
Yes, Apple and Pixar have always been separate, but they've both, spearheaded by Steve Jobs at various points in time. Although here's another page that's saying he is a founder of Pixar. I'm not entirely sure.
Well, the other thing that's worth discussing on this is the settlement agreement, and by the other terms of the settlement agreement, the companies will have to not they're not only prohibited from entering into new agreements or maintaining these agreements, but they also have to allow for compliance inspections by the Department of Justice, and on notice, the attorney general or an assistant attorney general actually can show up at the companies and request hard copies or electronic copies of the books, records, or any other type of electronic data that might pertain to this, and also interview some of the employees, and also request that the companies submit reports based on their compliance with the settlement agreement. And I think this is a 5-year settlement agreement, so for the next 5 years as of the date of the signing and approval, depending on the terms.
Anything else people want to cover with this story, or are we just about good?
I think we're all set.
I think we're pretty good. And on that note, why don't we go ahead and wrap? Thank you for listening. My name is David O'Brien, and with me were
Dominic Rabier.
And Ben Snitkoff.
Be sure to check us out next week and online at technicallylegal.org. You can follow us on Twitter at @TechLegal and send comments to podcasts at technicallylegal.org. We'll see you next week.